This is Classic Business with Michael Avery on Classic 102.7 in Gauteng and Fine Music Radio in Cape Town.
Well, we've been focusing an awful lot on NHI on the show since the bill was published last week and even before that. And the reason is, well, it's just too big of an issue to ignore. And I certainly feel, I feel torn on this issue. I'm going to be completely upfront. Clearly, we all need to appreciate that the current status quo cannot persist. It cannot be that only the upper echelon of our society have access to decent healthcare. But similar to the president's South African Renaissance bullet train city, we have neither the money, the bureaucratic prowess, nor the medical skills capacity to consider a shift of this magnitude. Forget about the huge scope for corruption when we look at past behavior. When one is talking about a medical scheme of this size, I think we also need to differentiate between access to healthcare, which most of the population has, and access to a reasonable level of healthcare, which they clearly don't. And it does raise all sorts of questions, too many for me to answer on my own. So we've invited a formidable panel. Once again, let's kick it off with Dr. Anban Pele, who's the Deputy Director General in the Department of Health for the South African National Health Insurance. Dr. Pele, thanks for joining us and always making yourself available. Much appreciated.
Good evening to you and good evening to the listeners.
In studio, we've got Dr. Rajesh Patel, who's Head of Risk and Benefit at the Board of Healthcare Funders of Southern Africa. Dr. Patel?
Good evening. Good evening to your listeners.
In our Fine Music Radio studio, we've got Aneria Bauer, who's a partner in the tax department at Bowman's. Aneria, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Good evening.
I trust the FMR team are treating you well down there.
Cape Town is spectacular as always.
As always, I'm sure it is. Very jealous. Lebogang Mulaife is the social policy coordinator at COSATU. Lebogang, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good evening to you and good evening to your listeners.
And that rounds off our foursome on the panel tonight. Dr. Pele, kick us off here. When it comes to admin and funding, and in the run-up to the implementation, I just wanted to find out whether government considered the impact of scrapping tax credits on medical scheme members who are lower income earners and might have to cancel their scheme membership if tax credits get cancelled. Some of these taxpayers earn above the 350,000 rand per annum threshold and as a result will have to pay full fees in public hospitals, which they can probably not afford either. So we might end up with this grouping without any access to healthcare, either in the private sector or the state, as there aren't any NHI structures in place yet to cover them.
Michael, on the issue of tax credits, I think it's fair to say that, yes, there are South Africans that are at the margin where the removal of the tax credits would increase their costs and obviously put them into strife. But there are many more households that actually can afford to release the tax credits and still live a comfortable life. I think the important point to remember is that the tax credits won't be removed in a single swoop. They would be reduced over time. And the idea is as the tax credits are being reduced, the National Health Insurance Fund benefits will increase so that those who are losing their tax credits will have the benefit of access to services through the National Health Insurance Fund. So it's not as if it's going to happen over a day and they're going to be left without any benefit in between.
So there will be a phased-in approach. It just, from my reading, wasn't too clear. Will that come through in subsequent law and regulation?
Yes. So remember that the National Treasury does this through the Money Bill. So each year they will reduce the extent to which the tax credits are effective and then slowly pull that down. And as they're reducing that, they will be increasing the National Health Insurance Fund funding so that we can expand our package of services.
Lebogang, from COSATU's perspective, and although COSATU is obviously supportive of the NHI, has there been any indications from unions that their members will accept it if government scraps their medical aid subsidy, which as an increase in medical scheme subsidy is part of the current public service bargaining discussions?
I think, Michael, we need to start from the basis of where this call for a national health insurance comes from. It's been a process of continuous consultation and communication with our members from a Congress level when we take our high policy decisions, as well as at a CEC level when we take our major decisions in between Congresses. And it has been a clear call from all our members that we are in full support of a national health insurance. This has been our call from 2007 already. In fact, our members are a bit agitated at how long it's taken us to get to the point where we actually have a bill and the establishment of the NHI fund. So it's good to just highlight that we have taken our members ever since 2007 up to this point. The only reason why medical aid and medical aid membership has been a prominent issue with regards to bargaining chamber councils is because up to this point, workers have had no other alternative other than medical aid membership. So what workers want to see is a phased-in approach, as what Dr. Pillay has been talking about. They want to see the establishment of this fund and progress moving forward. But by all means and purposes, workers are behind the national health insurance.
Will unions now demand the equivalent in cash to pay packages because the subsidy really formed part of cost to company?
We are still having our engagements around that particular issue. What you will know is that it impacts on what workers will be earning from a month-to-month basis. So these are engagements that we're still having at a NEDLAC level. We're also having these discussions at a bargaining chamber level. So again, this is a phased approach. We don't see a guillotine approach today where we have these credits and tomorrow we don't have them. We want to see a phased-in approach, and a phased-in approach while seeing the implementation of the NHI coming into effect.
And Aneria, just from that employee tax perspective, what impact do you see this having on personal income taxes that are already fairly high?
The difficulty at this stage is that it's not possible to get a sense of what the impact will be. The proposals in the NHI bill is still just, it's essentially creating a range of possibilities and different taxation options. But we don't have any sense as to what the cost will be for taxpayers. And there were additional information in various media reports, and some of that indicate that it may actually be beneficial for some taxpayers. Other taxpayers may potentially have to pay more. But I think the concern for taxpayers at this stage is that they see it as an additional cost. They do not necessarily trust that the NHI is going to deliver what it is supposed to deliver, and they are concerned that they're going to have to pay tax in addition to certain top-up medical contributions. And then combined with the medical scheme tax credits, which they're going to be forfeited, there is concern, and I think the concern is based on the uncertainty that they can't calculate the costs for them.
Dr. Pillay, I want to bring you back in here on this issue of costs. And I know the NHI policy paper states, and I want to quote here, focusing on the question of what the NHI will cost is the wrong approach. Surely that's rather disingenuous to say, because it's of paramount importance that we know what the NHI will cost before the country is plunged into further financial trouble.
I think it's important to appreciate that if you're saying how much is the NHI going to cost, the first question you have to answer is what services will you cover and what will you not cover? Because actually, you know, healthcare in terms of its needs has an unsatiable appetite. I mean, you could cover everything for everyone, although no country in the world does so. So to ask the question, well, how much is it going to cost? It depends what services you're going to cover, how many people have that burden of disease, and you need to talk about that in the year 2026 when the NHI is fully implemented, because between now and then, the NHI will be implemented in phases. It's like asking you, in the year 2026, how much do you think it would cost you for a basket of groceries in the supermarket? It's very difficult because you don't quite know what you're going to be buying, what it's going to cost, etc. So the more appropriate approach which the World Health Organization recommends to all countries implementing the national health insurance, is work on a short-term approach of 3 years, understand how much money you have, and how best can you structure your package around the amount of funds you have. Asking how much the NHI is going to cost, it depends how many diseases you want to cover and to what extent you want to cover those diseases. But you may not have the money for that, right? So the answer comes back to how much of money do you have. So why don't you start by asking the question, how much of money do you have? How best do you use these funds to make sure that people have a good quality of health care, and spend the money based on that?
I take your point that it's very difficult to forecast, but there are some very clever actuarial analysts out there who make a living from trying to forecast these things out over those sorts of time frames. There was Treasury, and it's an obvious question here, was supposed to release its costing of the NHI, and that was supposed to be published in conjunction with the NHI white paper. We haven't seen that yet. Perhaps, Dr. Patel, you can wade in onto this into this issue as to why we haven't perhaps seen that that cost yet.
No idea. But
I can respond to that.
Dr. Pillay, yes?
So look, if you look at Chapter 7 of the white paper, it outlines what Treasury had estimated in terms of the cost. But the economy obviously has changed, the burden of disease has changed, etc. So Treasury is revising their paper. Their timing didn't fit in with the release of the bill by Parliament because they weren't quite sure when Parliament was going to release the bill. But I anticipate that they would release their bill fairly soon because they're more or less towards the end of the work that they need to do.
So you will see
a revised costing. But I should say on the point you make about actuaries, if you go to the World Health Organization and ask them, all of the countries that employed actuaries to do the costing of their NHI, how accurate were they? And they'll tell you that all of them were wrong. So the point is, do you want to preoccupy yourself with a 5 and 10 year cost, or just focus on how much money you have for the next 3 years and just make sure that you have a package that fits in with that?
Dr. Patel?
Yeah, no, I agree with Anbin. The question when we ask, well, how much is it going to cost, is actually the wrong question. And as Anbin said, the question we need to ask is, how much money do you have available? And that's what we need to cost on and determine what we can cover. I think what we forget is that this Constitution and the Section 27 that talks about access to healthcare services, and there's a byline that says to the extent it's affordable. So quite simply, from a Constitution perspective, we can't spend more money than we actually have. If we do try to spend more money than we have, then yes, it's unconstitutional and the guys aren't doing their job properly. So critical here is to actually carve out the amount that will be available for the NHI, because at the end of the day, NHI is not going to cover services. It's not going to cover all people. So to some extent, you're still going to have to make allocation to the provinces, so that they can still run services for those that will not be covered by the NHI. And definitely we can't spend more money than we have available. And I think that's the important thing to take into consideration.
But we can say we're spending X amount in terms of our health budget in the public sector and make some assumptions on what a 1, 2 or 3% tax increase would add into that kitty, and say, well, that is a lump sum that we now have to work with, and then work backwards from there to say, well, what can we provide with that?
Spot on the mark. That's the right approach to the whole thing.
What does that mean then, Dr. Pillay, for the concurrent role of private medical schemes in that sort of interregnum?
So private medical schemes will obviously have to amend their benefit packages, because once the NHI kicks in and starts providing services for the entire population, including the medical scheme population who will be participating through the tax system, we would anticipate that no South African will expect to pay twice for the same benefit. And so medical schemes will then cover those services that the NHI fund is not going to cover.
When you look at it on the administration side of things, and I want to stay with you here, Dr. Pillay, because it's a government question, this, has there been any consideration of the administrative costs involved at the NHI, because we've also got the fact that the National Department of Health, the provincial departments of health will still need administrative funding outside of the NHI costs. And has there been consideration of private administration of the NHI? Because if you look at it, the private sector currently administers half of all healthcare spend, and it would be relatively easy to double their administrative capacity to cater for the NHI, where you look at something like the compensation fund, that's the closest approximation of a similar government administration. That would have to be 100 times bigger to cater for the NHI. What sort of administrative model are you considering here?
Well, the NHI policy talks about a publicly administered scheme. The detail of the administration is partly covered in the bill in terms of the various units. But the detail of who will administer that and how it will exactly be done will be largely a function of government. I hear your point about private administrators having the skills, but I think it's also important to remember that the private administrators are administering a system that's very different from the way NHI is going to operate. Remember that NHI is going to pay primary care providers by capitation, hospitals by DRGs, etc., which is a very different administrative system to what we have now in the private medical scheme sector. So whether they would be able to amend the way they do business and be able to support the NHI, time will tell. But at this stage, we're still in the process of developing what the administration will look like, and obviously we'll get into procurement processes around that. When that time comes, we'll have to see as to how administrators respond and everybody else who would potentially be interested in participating in the administration.
Dr. Patel, as the Board of Healthcare Funders representing a big chunk of the private sector in this, what role do you see the private sector playing when it comes to administration?
I tend to agree that if you've got existing infrastructure, the economies of scale will make it relatively cheap and efficient to administer compared to starting de novo. In South African history of starting computer systems de novo, we don't have much of a track record to show for that. But definitely, I think if the Department of Health can put out a technical specification of what they need in an administration system, there's a potential for putting out for a tender and obviously trying to get a cost of what it's going to be from scratch upwards. I still think that the kind of pricing that you can get with the economies of scale would make using existing systems reasonably efficient. But at the end of the day, it depends what the NHI can afford and what we're going to get out of it. To some extent, I don't agree with Dr. Pillay that it's a totally different type of administration system. Medical schemes have engaged with providers on a capitated basis. Yes, the level of administration is significantly less because you're making lump sum payments, etc., but your information system requirements and reporting system requirements are quite significantly increased in that type of product range as well.
And when it comes to administration, there's a labor side to this as well. Lebo Khang, what's the union response to the moving of services to district and national level? Because funding will obviously follow service. What happens to the large numbers of unionized staff in provincial health departments when the admin burden on provinces reduces radically and provinces cannot afford to employ the redundant staff any further?
Well, our view has always been that a fund of this magnitude will require a number of personnel as well as human resources in order to be able to ensure that the fund functions optimally. We are in a process where we are going to be instructing our bargaining council to have these conversations, especially with the Department of Health. They are in the process of reinvigorating as well as having a mass reorganization of how they envisage the implementation of the NHI. And these are the issues that we really want to put onto their table. What workers have asked us to ensure is that in our approach in achieving the national health insurance, we leave no one behind, which means we don't want to leave any of our workers behind. We want to ensure that workers continue to continue to have a job in the public service. So these are many of the demands. We are, especially when we go into our bargaining councils, these are a number of the demands that we are going to be putting onto the table to ensure that these workers are not left behind in any way. This is a big fund, and we believe that workers that are currently plying their trades in various scopes and spheres of government continue to play a role in the public sector.
Well, one wonders where the economies of scale benefits are going to come from in light of that. Anaria, in light of the current economic downturn and credit downgrades and the general gloominess around the South African economy, I take on board exactly what Dr. Pillay and Dr. Patel have to say about cutting our cloth accordingly. What can we afford? But is an increase in taxes to pay for free healthcare, even for those currently paying for themselves, a prudent choice? Should there not be an attempt to spend additional taxes in the public domain in order to improve services there?
Well, what one shouldn't lose sight of is this is a two-pronged process. On the one side, it is improving the services provided from an NHI perspective. And then the idea is to use the private sector money to improve that. So on paper, it seems to work well. I think just taxpayers have gotten so used to having to provide privately for those services that the government just cannot provide, for example, security, schooling, medical, etc. And that is a big move from a taxpayer perspective, where something which has been funded privately by taxpayers is now being moved back to the state. And there are assurances that for most taxpayers, the cost will not be more. And what I find quite interesting is that there were some comments saying that those medical aid contributions are effectively payment for a public service, so that even if taxpayers pay that with after-tax money, it's actually a form of tax. So the idea is to reallocate that. So taxpayers are assured that they won't pay extra, but I think there's a lot of skepticism because the taxpayers do not see the government in a position to actually fulfill those promises.
I think that really is the nub, Dr. Pillay. When we see a lot of the skepticism, cynicism, call it what you will, some hand-wringing and fear around the NHI, is the fact that what we have seen, I mean, Eskom, for example, is currently being broken up into three because it's too large to administer efficiently. The NHI fund will manage twice the budget that Eskom does. Do we have the capacity to manage such a large SOE if we're breaking up a smaller one as being too large to manage and having been riddled with corruption and mismanagement? How can we ensure that we don't repeat those same mistakes with an NHI fund?
Well, I think it's important that everyone reads the bill and understands what measures we've put in place, particularly around the risks that you've highlighted. But there are many other risks as well. And to make sure that we build a national health insurance system like many other countries in the world have, that's an efficient system for all its citizens and provides that level of security and social solidarity that we as South Africans should be proud of.
How was the decision reached for the single tax-funded NHI fund in the current form? Because if you look at the research from other single-payer countries, Estonia, Taiwan, Canada, Cuba, they indicate that this type of model isn't really suitable for developing countries, especially not ones with our disease burden.
Sorry, I didn't get that question. Could you repeat it?
The research from other single-payer countries, Cuba, Canada, Taiwan, and there are many others, indicate that this type of model of a single tax-funded NHI isn't suitable for developing countries, and especially not one with our disease burden and as small a tax base as we have.
I'm not aware of that research. I mean, we shared our NHI proposals with the World Health Organization, the World Bank, the OECD, as well as many of the countries that you mentioned, and none of them have indicated anything that's in the policy proposals that would cause a problem. And none of them have said to us, "Please don't do this. This is a bad idea, or this is not good, etc." We have had proposals that were in there that they've advised us to take out, but the issues you raised were not raised by any of them.
I'll share that research with you after the show, Dr. Pillay. Just one last question, Aneri. If we look at the Davis Tax Committee, it states that the tax to GDP ratio will need to rise quite substantially to fund the NHI. One does have to raise the question as to what impact that might have on job losses and losses in tax income.
Yeah, it is quite substantial. I think what is quite positive is that the NHI bill is very hesitant with respect to promising funding, and it talks about the evaluation of new tax options only in phase six. So it seems that there is, from a fiscal perspective, caution to ensure that whatever is introduced will be affordable. And hopefully one will then, when we come to phase six, one will see that caution to ensure that this will not essentially make things worse rather than improving it as what the intention is.
That's all the time we have for tonight. Anerea Bauer, partner at Tax at Bowman, thank you very much as well to Dr. Anbann Pillay, Deputy Director General for the South African National Health Insurance, Dr. Rajesh Patel, Head of Risk and Benefit of the Board of Healthcare Funders of Southern Africa, and Lebogang Molaifi, Social Policy Coordinator at COSATU. Melissa Stevens in the Jazz Lounge in Cape Town, and in Gauteng, Carolyn Steyn up next with Winding Down.